Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be in a listen-only mode until the question-answer session. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. With that, it is my pleasure to turn over today's call to Ms. Loretta Jackson-Brown. You may begin.
Thank you, Tricia. Good afternoon. I'm Loretta Jackson-Brown, and I'm representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity, COCA, with the Emergency Communication System at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I am delighted to welcome you to today's COCA conference call, The Burden of Influenza and Chronic Illness. We are pleased to have with us today Dr. Joseph Breezy, Chief Influenza Division at Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Pamela Allweiss, Consultant, Division of Diabetes Translation at Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In addition to our CDC presenters, we have two presenters representing our COCA partner organizations. From the American Academy of Physician Assistants, we have Physician Assistant Anthony Brenneman, University of Iowa, Carver College of Medicine Physician Assistant Program. And from the American Nephrology Nurses Association, we have RN Carrie Holloway, Fresenius Medical Care, North America. During today's call, you will hear the presenters referring to slides in their PowerPoint presentation. The PowerPoint slide set is available from our COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on COCA calls. The slide set can be found under the call-in number and call passcode. The objectives for today's call are that participants will be able to list current Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommendations for influenza vaccination, identify the types of vaccines and antiviral coverage that are appropriate for people with diabetes, describe key sick day rules healthcare providers should emphasize to people with diabetes, identify indications and contraindications for influenza vaccination in individuals with cancer, and discuss the vulnerability of the chronic kidney disease population to influenza. Following the presentation, you will have an opportunity to ask our presenters questions. Dialing star 1 will put you into the queue for questions. In compliance with continuing education requirements, all presenters must disclose any financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters, as well as any use of unlabeled product or product under investigational use. CDC, our planners, and our presenters wish to disclose that they have no financial interests or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. This presentation does not include the discussion of the unlabeled use of a product or products under investigational use. There is no commercial support for this presentation. Today's first presenter is Dr. Joseph Breezy. He is a captain with the U.S. Public Health Service and chief of the Influenza Division at CDC. He serves as the principal liaison between CDC and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices on Influenza Vaccine Recommendations for the United States and leads the committee's Influenza Vaccine Working Group. The next presenter will be Dr. Pamela Allweiss, endocrinologist at University of Kentucky Medical School and consultant, Division of Diabetes Translation, CDC. During the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, Dr. Allweiss developed content for education of healthcare professionals and consumers and conducted multiple presentations within CDC and outside of CDC on the topic of diabetes and the flu. Following Dr. Allweiss will be PA Anthony Brenneman, Associate Professor and Associate Director, University of Iowa, Physician Assistant, Internal Medicine, Adult Bone Marrow Transplant, University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics, Iowa City, at Iowa Carver College of Medicine and Physician Assistant Program. Our final speaker will be RN Carrie Holloway, Infection Control Specialist and Clinical Quality Manager at Fresenius Medical Care, North America. A dialysis nurse for more than 30 years, Ms. Holloway is the Corporate Infection Control Specialist for Fresenius Medical Care, where she is responsible for developing policies and procedures related to patient infection prevention. If you're following along on the slides, you should be on slide 6. Again, the PowerPoint slide set is available from our COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. At this time, please welcome our first presenter, Dr. Breezy.
Yeah, thanks, Loretta. Hey, everybody, this is Joe Breezy. I'm from the Influenza Division. Thanks for the chance to lead off this call. I wanted to give everybody a short update on sort of the salient parts of influenza, but mainly focus on influenza vaccine recommendations and turn it over to the experts to talk about influenza in special subpopulations. If you look at slide 8 first, let me just say a couple of things. First, that as you know, influenza disease and timing of disease varies pretty substantially from year to year and is unpredictable. That said, 5 to 20% of the U.S. population are infected, and the highest infection rates are among children each year. CDC has updated its estimates on the mortality associated with influenza disease annually just this year, and we estimate that somewhere around 3,000 to 50,000 people die each year of influenza. More people die in years where influenza A, H3N2 viruses predominate, and as you know, most of those deaths are among people over 65 years old. In addition, an average of about 220,000 hospitalizations occur each year, and again, the majority of those occur in people over 65 years old as well. If you look at 9, it's meant to make the point that even though everybody can get the flu each year and should get the flu vaccine each year, there are clearly subpopulations that are at higher risk of acquiring influenza complications if they get influenza infection. In addition to kids, young kids, especially kids under 2 and people over 65, pregnant women, Alaskan Natives, and American Indians, the long list of things you see there are people with underlying diseases who we know have higher risk of complications, hospitalizations, and death if they get influenza infection and therefore are important to protect with vaccination, and we'll get to that in a minute. Evidence of that is given on slide 10. Slide 10 represents some data from the pandemic last year, which again showed us that people with underlying health disorders, some at least, were more likely to get severely ill with influenza. I won't go through the slide in detail, but just notice that the bars represent the prevalence of underlying risk factors, underlying known risk factors that I listed on the page before, among people hospitalized in the first bar, among people who died in the blue bar, the middle bar, and among the general U.S. population in the green bar. And just notice that the prevalence of those conditions in the more severely ill people are always higher than the prevalence in the general population, indicating again that people with those conditions have a higher risk of severe outcomes should they get infected with flu each year. In slide 11, and I just want to highlight that ever since the HHS, or the Public Health Service, began to make influenza vaccine recommendations in 1960, and this is a screenshot of the first recommendations that were written down from the Public Health Service. If you look at slide 12, you see the inset that I highlighted in slide 11, just to show that even from the very first, it was clear that people with underlying cardiac, pulmonary, and endocrine disorders were at higher risk for influenza complications and therefore were targeted early on for vaccination. In slide 13, you'll see that despite the fact that we started targeting high-risk groups early on more than 50 years ago, over the last decade or so, there's clearly been an expansion of influenza recommendations to include more and more people, and that represents a realization and appreciation of the fact that the disease burden is broad with influenza, and everybody has a chance of getting sick and severely sick. And you don't have to read the whole thing, but look at the part I've circled down at the bottom. Note that this year, for the first time, CDC is recommending that everyone over 6 months of age get influenza vaccine to protect themselves against influenza and to protect their loved ones from getting influenza from them. If you go to slide 14, note that the recommendations this year are for a single vaccine and not two vaccines. Remember, last year we had a pandemic vaccine and a trivalent seasonal vaccine. This year, post-pandemic, we're back to just the trivalent seasonal vaccine recommended for everybody over 6 months of age without a contraindication. And note that the vaccine strains in the vaccine this year will include the pandemic strain from last year. In addition, a slightly updated A, H3N2 strain, and the same B strain circulating that was included last year's vaccine in the U.S. Note that every one of these strains is circulating in the U.S. and globally right now, and so we think that the vaccine not only is important, but should protect against the viruses we're seeing this year. And just to finish that up, the next two slides represent an update on what we are seeing in the U.S. given our surveillance at CDC. In slide 15, we're looking at outpatient visits, and this is trends in outpatient visits associated with influenza-like illness. And you see that at the far right side of the graph, we're starting to trend upward in terms of influenza-like illness, but not yet seeing much disease nationally. But if you look at the map, which is on slide 16, this represents state health departments' assessments of how much flu they're seeing. You see that we're not seeing much flu most places in the country, but just in the southeast United States, we're starting to see an increase in influenza activity now. So it looks like we're just getting the season started right now, which goes back into our recommendations for vaccination. It should be done as soon as possible before influenza gets in your community. And so my key points are clearly, in slide 17, clearly people with chronic medical conditions are at higher risk, and many of those people don't know they're at higher risk, and outreach is needed for those people. That universal vaccine recommendations this year for the first time should encourage not only everybody to get vaccinated, but hopefully will increase the coverage of people around people with high-risk conditions, therefore decreasing their risk of getting infected. Finally, vaccine coverage, despite having been recommended for high-risk populations for over 50 years, still is way too low, and we need to bring that up to protect more people. And finally, we're just getting started with the season, and now's a great time to get vaccinated. That's all I had, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Allweis.
Well, thank you very much for this wonderful background, because it's really helping to make the case on why people with chronic conditions, especially folks who have diabetes, should get the flu shot. We've also seen that some of the people at high risk, such as the American Indian, Alaska Native population, also have a very high burden of diabetes. We have an epidemic of diabetes with about 24 million people who have diabetes. So we have a lot of work to do. If we go to slide 19, the objectives are that we want to show you the impact of influenza on people with diabetes, four messages for actions to reduce the impact of flu upon people with diabetes, and also some tools that you can use. We go to slide 20. It isn't just the flu for a person who has diabetes. Influenza can be a very serious disease. It's much more dangerous for adults and children who have diabetes. They are much more apt to develop secondary complications, such as pneumonia. People with diabetes are six times more likely to be hospitalized with influenza complications, and almost three times more likely to die from this plain old simple flu. The other thing is, anytime a person with diabetes gets any type of infection, blood sugars can fluctuate. Certainly, we can see blood sugars go up, and sometimes our people with diabetes, if they're monitoring their sugars on a regular basis, know that they might have some type of infection because their blood sugar levels might go up. But on the other hand, if they're not eating, like because their appetite might be decreased because they are sick, their blood sugars may actually go down. So it's very, very important to monitor the blood sugars, as we'll talk about later. But people with type 1 diabetes certainly are at risk of developing diabetic ketoacidosis if they do get the flu. Slide 21, these are the four messages that we want providers to know. We want to increase the vaccination rate. We want the providers to use antiviral drugs early in people who have diabetes and symptoms of the flu. We want to be sure that you and your patients know sick day rules. Diabetes is a chronic condition. We have to teach people self-management skills. And the fourth message is to encourage your patients to take everyday precautions. We cannot forget about that. Slide 22 is, what can we do? Who should get vaccinated? Well, as Dr. Brzee said, everyone, but especially you as the healthcare provider. Last year, during the H1N1 pandemic, many healthcare providers did not get the H1N1 vaccination. We really want the healthcare providers and everybody who works in your offices to receive an influenza vaccine. Very, very important as just a role model. And the vaccine works. Slide 23. In people with diabetes, if they get the influenza vaccination, it's associated with a 72% reduction in hospitalizations in people who have diabetes. So it definitely works. It's the most effective intervention for reducing the impact of influenza. And we also want people to know that they need the shot, not the nasal mist. People need the dead vaccine, so to speak. They definitely need the shot, not the live virus. So we want people to understand that. We also want people to know that they need a pneumonia shot at some point as well. But the thing is, only 32% of people with chronic conditions, including diabetes, got a flu shot in 2008-2009. People with any chronic condition are so busy handling all the aspects of their chronic condition that sometimes getting a plain old flu shot just is buried. So we really want to increase that uptake of the flu vaccine because it is very, very effective in decreasing complications. Slide 25, vaccination is also important for the people who live and work and take care of people with diabetes as well. Getting a flu shot is part of an overall diabetes management plan. And as we said before, a pneumococcal vaccine should be given at some point as well. Slide 26, what are some steps that you, as a clinician, can do to increase your patient's vaccination rate? Well, as I said before, be sure that you and everyone who works in your practice is vaccinated. And also tell your patients this, because it says, okay, if my healthcare provider has done it, at least they're walking the walk. The other thing is, recommend the flu shot at every patient encounter from the moment the flu shot is available until December, January, and February. Many of our folks with diabetes come in for all different kinds of reasons. We cannot forget that this is a very important part of their whole regimen. Use reminders and recalls as well, because that sometimes can help as well. Slide 27, another recommendation from the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases on how to increase the vaccination rate in people with diabetes, hold vaccine-only clinics. We see this with many of our partners, such as the drugstores and work sites. You and your office sometimes can have a vaccine-only clinic. Continue vaccination also into December, January, and beyond. Somehow people think if they didn't get their vaccine in October that they shouldn't get it. No, we want people to continue getting their vaccine. And also maybe having standing orders to vaccinate anyone with diabetes can also be an effective way of increasing the uptake of the vaccine. The next message is antiviral medication therapy. Last week on one of the COCA calls, there was an entire call on antiviral medication, and you can also find that on the COCA website. But people with diabetes are prime candidates to receive antiviral medication if they develop symptoms of influenza. You should not wait for lab test confirmation. It's not necessary. And please remember that the antiviral drugs are most effective when started within 48 hours of the onset of symptoms. So every minute counts. When you are giving your folks the flu shot, talk to them about this as well. And, of course, clinical judgment is very, very important. But please understand that antiviral medications do not replace the flu shot. This is just if a person does get sick to help to prevent more complications. The primary medications include Tamiflu and Relenza. They're active against both influenza A and B viruses. Now, the side effects, the most common side effects can be some nausea. And as I said before, chemoprophylaxis with antivirals is not a substitute for the influenza vaccine. Slide 30 goes to our other message, sick day rules. Every person with diabetes should know what to do if he or she gets sick. It could be any type of illness, not just the flu, but they need to make a plan. They need to know that they should keep on taking the usual dose of pills or insulin to monitor their blood sugars on a regular basis. Many people say, oh, I'm not eating and I'm sick. Well, I don't have to take my medication. Very important to have a plan and to know what to do if the blood sugar levels go up or if they go down. Sometimes people may need more or less insulin, so to have a plan is very, very important. If a person cannot eat their usual diet, it is still very important to avoid dehydration. So people need to have enough soft foods or drink enough liquids to prevent dehydration. Slide 31, we want people to drink extra calorie-free liquids, maybe in small sips. We want people to check their temperature every 4 hours. If their temperature is over 101, we want them to call the office. For people who have type 1 diabetes, to check the urine for ketones. And definitely if the blood sugars go above 250 to 300, to call the healthcare provider so that we can make changes in the regimen or have the patient come into the office or into the emergency room. And certainly these are folks who have symptoms. That would be the time to assess the patient for antiviral medication as well. We also want people to follow healthy habits with hand washing, staying home when they're sick, et cetera, the everyday precautions. You can find all of this information, slide 32, on the cdc.gov diabetes website. We have all of the sick day rules, and we do have the recommendations for influenza vaccines. So our messages are people with diabetes are at higher risk for complications. Be sure they get the influenza shot, not the nasal mist. Be sure they at some point get a pneumonia shot. Make sure that they know about antiviral medications, sick day rules, and, of course, everyday precautions. Thank you very much, and we'll go on to Anthony Brenneman, who will talk about cancer. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Allweiss. And when I'm referring to the vaccine, I'm also going to only be referring to the trivalent inactivated influenza vaccine. Immunocompromised patients are not approved to receive the live attenuated influenza vaccine. And it's at this time, it's also felt that close family members that should not receive the live attenuated vaccine, although there's no direct correlation between the flu mist and transmission to these immunocompromised patients due to their severe immunocompromised state. It's felt that everyone should receive the trivalent inactivated vaccine. So moving to slide 34. As way of background, the mortality rate in this group of patients is extremely high. It can reach up to 9% of those infected by flu, which is four times higher than the general population. There's also evidence that these patients that are hospitalized, 31% go on to need further skilled care, again, a significant increase over the general population. Evidence also exists that fewer than 50% of this patient population is vaccinated, so it's incumbent upon us to be asking our patients whenever we see them and we know that they have cancer if they've gotten their flu vaccine and to encourage that they do so. Influenza can result in secondary and more severe complications in this population, especially noting bacterial pneumonias, worsening of chronic respiratory and cardiac conditions can occur. It is a universally well-tolerated vaccine in this population compared to the general population, and they have, just like the general population, transient symptoms of local muscle soreness, myalgias, and arthralgias, but serious complications are extremely rare. So therefore, the benefit in this group of patients significantly outweighs the benefit. Slide 35, just some general signs and symptoms in these patients. They present much like the general population with fevers, myalgias, and constitutional symptoms. The challenges come because their diseases sometimes present with the exact same kind of findings, the fevers and myalgias, as well as treatments from their chemotherapy. So sometimes the flu is masked to the patient and to the care provider. So we need to maintain a high level of suspicion and start our patients on antiviral medications early on. We can make the diagnosis by using the nasal saline wash with the quick viral detection methods, but having a negative outcome doesn't preclude treatment, so we should go ahead and start those treatments early on, as Dr. Allweis had indicated in her discussion. Slide 36, I am going to proceed through talking about different cancer patients based on different population groupings. There's some prior studies that have led providers to be concerned that maybe the viral load isn't enough to protect these patients, and so I want to talk through some of the findings and why that might be. So I'm going to start with slide 37 in the pediatric population. Clearly, there's a higher incidence of influenza within this group of patients, which leads to a greater morbidity and mortality. The challenge also is if these patients develop influenza, it can interrupt or delay their therapy up to 80% of the time, which has long-term sequela and poor outcomes for these patients. Prior studies indicated that maybe the vaccination was associated with a suboptimal immunogenicity within these groups. When they looked at the groups a little bit more closely, though, they did note that all of these patients were mounting an immune response. It may have been not up to the level of the general population. Some of these patients may be responding to one or two of the viral strains within the trivalent vaccine, or their total serotitr wasn't as high as the general population. But they do note that they have responded at some level. This was found in the 2009 Cochrane Review, which showed the efficacy for the antiviral medication in the pediatric setting, as well as its excellent safety profile. So here they are recommending routine vaccination. There is a timing issue within this population, as in all of the adult populations, and I'll be talking about that towards the end of this discussion. Moving to slide 38, adults with solid tumors. These patients demonstrate an ability to mount protective antibody titers. When we look at those studies, it is notable that most of the patients that received the vaccine and responded weren't receiving treatment at the time, although some of the patients within the studies were receiving chemotherapy at the time of vaccination, and they did demonstrate seroconversion. Based on that, in a study by Earle, they've demonstrated a decreased rate of influenza in these patients that have been immunized, as well as decreases in delays for treatment and decreases in morbidity and mortality in the vaccinated groups. On slide 39, patients with hematologic malignancies, initial studies were showing that these patients didn't respond as well as healthy controls or patients with solid tumors, and some felt that this may have been related to their disease type since it was directly affecting their immune systems. However, when they separated out the patients that were not receiving chemotherapy at the time of vaccination, they did note that these patients responded equivalently to the controls that they were compared to, which would suggest that the treatment itself was causing a decreased response and not the disease. Two studies that have shown this, one on lymphoproliferative disorders, found that 60% of those patients developed seroprotection to all three viral strains, which compared favorably to the controls at 80%, and only one patient in the treated group ended up with a case of influenza. Another study with patients with hematologic malignancies who were vaccinated during active treatment showed that they were able to mount significant responses compared with their pre-vaccination baseline, and despite a local epidemic outbreak in that area, none of those patients developed the flu. On slide 40, it may indicate the discrepancies in this way, another reason that we see these discrepancies in some of the studies. Typically, the general population takes 2 to 4 weeks to respond to the vaccination when we're looking at seropositive levels. In a study by Maza and Yale looking at non-Hodgkin lymphoma patients, it may take this group of patients up to 12 weeks to seroconvert and be able to have enough protection to prevent the flu from occurring. These same individuals went on to look at long-term response in this group of patients and found good reactions 1 and 6 months out, as well as following up over two consecutive flu seasons. Moving to slide 41 and talking about patients with the hematopoietic stem cell transplants, there is some data that's limited by a lack of uniformity in the timing of vaccination relative to the transplant itself. That's because centers that do hematopoietic stem cell transplants have different times that they recommend vaccinating patients, so there's variability across the nation in that. And then also the numbers are lower, so they combine autologous and allogeneic bone marrow transplants together to come up with recommendations. And what we have found is that the autologous transplant patients, those receiving their own stem cells, and the allogeneic patients receiving someone else's marrow, have different response times to the vaccine. But larger studies have demonstrated evidence of efficacy and a protective effect from this intervention. When we look again in this population, timing is crucial. For the autologous transplants, we start to see seropositivity conversion about 3 months out from transplant, with good conversion at about 6 months out from transplant. For those with an allogeneic bone marrow transplant receiving someone else's marrow, they start converting at about 6 months, but with good conversion at about 1 year out from transplant. So vaccine is recommended in this population as well. On page 42, slide 42, we're talking about the immunotherapy and biological agents, clearly a strong advancement in cancer therapy. And one of the drugs that's most often used is rituximab, which is an integral in the treatment of B-cell lymphoproliferative disorders. Rituximab causes an induced B-cell depletion by complement-dependent and antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. Recovery of these peripheral blood B lymphocytes begins 6 months after treatment and does not return to pretreatment levels for up to 1 year. This possibly causes a decrease in acquired immunity via inhibition of memory B cells and may explain why some of these studies are mixed, some recommending treatment and others not, because it may have been where when the vaccine itself was given. There's no signs or recommendations against vaccinating these patients. There's been no adverse outcomes. So we're recommending that these patients also receive the annual flu vaccine. So if we go to 43, I've mentioned timing as a key within the cancer populations. The recommendations are to vaccinate 2 weeks before initiation of chemotherapy, or if that is not, if you're not able to do that, to wait until the white count recovers to greater than 1.0 on the CBC. If that's not able to be done, 2 months after completion of chemotherapy or before each flu season is recommended for these patients. Finally, for actively treated patients, vaccinating the furthest possible time point away from treatment during a given cycle is recommended. So, for instance, a typical cancer cycle may be every 4 weeks for the chemotherapy. So vaccinating between week 2 and 3 after the chemotherapy is given is the most optimal time point, and if the white count is above 1.0. Slide 44, like our other groups of patients, close contacts are underutilized in getting their vaccinations. Less than 45% among family members of cancer patients are getting vaccinated. So again, we want to encourage that at every step and every chance that we can get. Going to slide 45. Treatment, clearly prevention is the best way to prevent and to keep our cancer patients safe. Use of pneumococcal vaccine is recommended, but if these patients do develop flu, use of anti-influenza and antiviral agents. Most oncologists are recommending a combination of the neuraminidase inhibitors and adamantane in these severely immunocompromised patients. So in conclusion, clinically, it's noted that immunized patients, even with lower response rates, do better than their non-immunized comparisons. That a majority of patients who have not received treatment for greater than 30 days can mount immunologically favorable reactions to vaccines. Vaccinating the furthest time point from treatment appears to be the most preferential, and vaccinating patients with cancer is safe, minimally invasive, and inexpensive. So at this time, I will turn it over to Carrie Holloway, who will talk about chronic kidney disease.
Thank you very much. And if you will go to slide 47, that's where we'll start. Today, I'd like to share some information on chronic kidney disease, a population that's vulnerable to the influenza. In addition, I have some slides I will be sharing with you. It's important to understand how the flu affects certain population of patients, as you have heard on the previous presentations. One such population of patients is the chronic kidney disease population. Influenza vaccination rates in the general population have been associated with improved outcomes, yet high-risk populations, such as CKD patients, have received little attention in determining the potential benefits. I will discuss why vaccination is important, the impact of influenza on this population, and recommendations for the flu vaccine. If you go to slide 48, it's estimated 10 to 20% of the U.S. population is infected with influenza yearly. It's estimated that the flu was responsible for an average of 226,000 influenza-related hospitalizations during the years 1979 to 2001, and about half of among those were greater than 65 years of age. And there was an estimated annual average of approximately 36,000 deaths during the years 1990 through 1999, more than 90% in adults greater than 65 years. Patients with CKD ESRD are likely to be at high risk to influenza infection and complications given their altered immune status. In addition, infectious disease is the second leading cause of death among the CKD ESRD patient, and pulmonary infectious mortality is tenfold higher in this population than in the general population, especially among the aged and those with increased comorbidities. CKD is among the comorbid conditions at an increased risk of influenza complications. If you'll go to slide 49, in 2005, approximately 485,000 people received renal replacement therapy, 340,000 of who were receiving maintenance dialysis. It is projected that there will be approximately 710,000 end-stage renal disease patients by the year 2015. Potential risk factors for infection among patients with CKD ESRD include advanced age, high burden of coexisting illnesses, hypoalbuminemia, immunosuppressive therapy, nephrotic syndrome, uremia, anemia, and malnutrition. These risk factors may contribute to complications in this patient population, such as pneumonia, CNS complications, and death, with infection leading the second leading cause of death. With the projected number of patients greater than 700,000, greater efforts are needed to identify potentially modifiable risks to decrease the burden on patients, families, and the healthcare system. Slide 50. CKD ESRD patients are immunocompromised and are at a higher risk for infection because these patients are sicker, often with dysfunctional immune systems. The CKD patient has a greater disease burden, including cardiovascular, infectious, inflammatory, and uremic conditions. They have increased susceptibility for infection, decreased response to vaccination, and decreased maintenance of protective antibodies. Some implications to consider are the results of studies in the general population do not always apply to CKD patients. The vaccines may need to be evaluated individually. The risk and benefits, including cost issues, need to be weighed, and there is a great need to prevent infection in the ESRD population. Number 51, vaccination is associated with decreased likelihood of hospitalization and mortality compared with patients who are not vaccinated. All CKD patients should receive an annual influenza vaccination because of the virulence and risk associated with influenza virus and infection. Vaccination may prevent infections which contribute to decreased co-infections or superimposed infections, decreased burden and disease burden and hospitalization, and decreased severity of illness for breakthrough infections. In addition, the likelihood of an acute myocardial infarction has been shown to decrease when patients are vaccinated, an important consideration given the high risk for cardiac events in the ESRD population. 52. Infection is the leading cause of death in patients with ESRD. Numerous risk factors predispose patients with CKD and ESRD to infection. As discussed in an earlier slide, these include advanced age, high burden of coexisting illnesses, uremia, anemia, and malnutrition. In addition, infection-related hospitalizations contribute substantially to excess morbidity and mortality in patients with ESRD, making infection the leading cause of death in this patient population? Number 53. Among Medicare beneficiaries aged 66 years, patients diagnosed with CKD seem to have substantially higher rates of hospitalization for diagnoses of pneumonia and sepsis compared with patients without diagnosed CKD. In addition to an increased incidence of being hospitalized with infection, patients with CKD have longer lengths of hospital stay during infection-related admissions compared with patients without CKD. Admissions are predominantly due to cardiovascular disease and infection. 54. Influenza infections are associated with thousands of deaths every year in the United States, with the majority of deaths among adults greater than 65 years of age. More than 30,000 adults 65 years or older died each year from flu-related complication during the years 1990 and 1999. 55. Because CKD and ESRD patients are immunocompromised, they represent a high-risk group for developing infectious disease. Despite that, there has been a slow increase in the number of CKD and ESRD patients vaccinated. The number of patients vaccinated may be underestimated, as many patients receive vaccination outside the dialysis center, and these numbers may not be always captured. Vaccination was significantly associated with a decreased risk for any cause death and cause-specific death in hemodialysis. It's important that all kidney patients get the proper immunization as part of their essential care. 57. Vaccination for influenza reduced hospitalization risk for pneumonia or influenza by 27% in the community-dwelling patients 65 or older. The rates of reported influenza vaccinations continued to improve overall, reaching 62.4% in 2008, though they remain noticeably lower in children than in adults. As this slide in demonstrates, rates in adults increased to 5.19, 60.4, 60.6, and 70.9% respectively for those aged 20 to 44, 45 to 64, 65 to 74, and 75 and older. In 2008, rates in white, Native American, Asian, and Hispanic patients ranged between 61 to 64.5%, while the rate for African Americans was slightly lower at 58.9%. These rates could be interpreted with caution, as patients may be vaccinated through non-Medicare programs. And this information comes from the USRDS data system. Slide 58. The CDC, as mentioned before, recommends that all persons get the influenza vaccination, specifically those patients with chronic medical conditions that make them more likely to have complications with influenza should get an annual vaccination. In addition to the CDC, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services considers influenza vaccination as a component of quality assessment and performance improvement for the ESRD population. The 2010-2011 trivalent vaccine contains the influenza A or the H1N1 vaccine virus derived from the 2009 pandemic virus, and it does not require two separate injections. Studies have proven that getting all the proper immunizations can prevent illness and decrease the need for hospital stays. The influenza vaccination has shown a 5 to 15% reduction in hospitalization for pneumonia, influenza, and up to a 7% reduction in all-cause hospitalization. There has also been a 15 to 36% reduction in death from infections and a 4 to 14% reduction in death risk for all causes. Since people on dialysis are at a higher risk for infection, it makes sense that getting the proper vaccinations can prevent illness. Among the aged and those with increased comorbidities, influenza vaccination decreases the likelihood of hospitalization, mortality, and cost. Slide 60. The vaccination rate in the CKD ESRD population falls well below targets for the general population and is consistent with the influenza rates previously reported in the United States Renal Data System 2000 and the 2001 annual data report, while vaccination rates have been climbing in the general population. Vaccination for influenza reduced death risk by 48% in community-dwelling patients aged 65 and older. By modality, influenza vaccination rates are highest in hemodialysis patients at 67% compared to 61.8% and 46.1% in the peritoneal dialysis and the transplant patient. In conclusion, the risk for acute infection seems to occur more frequently in the setting of kidney disease and is associated with poorer outcomes compared with the general population. With the number of CKD patients rising, the cost to the Medicare system is projected to be at $54 billion by 2020. Annual influenza vaccination is the best way to reduce the risk for complications from influenza infections and reduce some of the burden on the Medicare system. Quality improvement programs focused on influenza vaccination rates are needed to address this vulnerable population of patients. Thank you.
Thank you to all the presenters for providing our COCA audience with such a wealth of information. We will now open up the lines for the question and answer session.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Please be sure to unmute your phone and clearly record your name when prompted. Again, that's star 1 to ask a question, and we will allow a few moments for any questions to come in. Again, that's star 1 for a question. I show no questions at this time.
I would ask our presenters if they have anything else that they would like to recap as a perhaps emphasize or take-home message for the audience.
Yeah, this is Pam Allweis. I think one point was made about folks with cancer and their family members that the people around them should possibly get the inactivated vaccine as well. For people with diabetes, their family members or caregivers can get the nasal mist unless that person himself has a condition such as diabetes or cancer or chronic kidney disease that would say that he or she should get the shot, not the nasal mist. But if it's a young, healthy person who is around or taking care of somebody with diabetes, that person may get the nasal mist if the person does not have a condition that would require the shot. So that's a little bit different. People with diabetes are functionally immune suppressed, but not to the extent as folks who may have cancer and chemotherapy. So I wanted to bring up that point. I was very glad that it was brought up about what type of vaccine the caregivers and family members should get. So with diabetes, it's a little bit different.
Thank you, Dr. Allweis.
Excuse me, we do have one question. Would you like to take that?
Please.
Okay, it's Jacqueline Butler. Your line is open.
Yes, I was interested in finding out, because you gave the data for 2008, the percentage of people receiving influenza. Now, where would I go for 2009? Because I'm trying to, in our community, go into the African-American community and try to educate them more and get an influenza vaccination. So I would like to be able to capture those numbers from that data that you receive, if I'm able to.
Yeah, this is Joe Brzee from CDC Flu Division. We do coverage surveys to figure out how much vaccine is used in different populations each year in a few different ways. A lot of that data is on our website. If you go to cdc.gov and migrate to the influenza website, there'll be some areas that talk about influenza vaccine coverage, and you can check there. If not, you can send me a note at jsb6@cdc.gov, and I can find the information you need.
Okay, thank you.
And a reminder that you can also email us at coca@cdc.gov as well.
Oh, yeah, better yet, in fact, because the coverage data are actually not in my group, but we can find it for you.
I have no other questions at this time.
On behalf of COCA, I would like to thank everyone for joining us today with a special thank you to our presenters, Dr. Breese, Dr. Allwise, P.A. Brenneman, and R.N. Carrie Holloway. If you have additional questions for today's presenters, please email us at coca@cdc.gov. Put the presenter's name in the subject line of your email, and we will ensure that your email is forwarded to him or her for a response. Again, that email address is coca@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and a transcript will be posted to the COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA within the next few days. Continuing education credits are available for this call. Those who participated in today's COCA conference call and would like to receive continuing education credit should complete the online evaluation by January 10, 2011, using course code EC1648. That is E as in Echo, C as in Charlie, and the numbers 1648. For those who would like to complete the online evaluation between January 11, 2011 and January 10, 2012, use course code WD1648. That is W as in Walter, D as in Delta, and the numbers 1648. All continuing education credit and contact hours for COCA conference calls are issued online through TCE Online, the CDC Training and Continuing Education online system, at www.cdc.gov/TCEonline. To receive information about upcoming COCA calls, subscribe to COCA by sending an email to coca@cdc.gov and write subscribe in the subject line. Thank you again for being a part of today's COCA conference call. Have a great day.